You might have heard of the thing called forever chemicals. They are turning up in farmers' fields and in cattle. They get into the crops and the cows because a biomass sludge was used as fertilizer. It turns out that sludge had these forever chemicals in it, and now that's a big problem. My guest today discusses with me a bit of the history of forever chemicals, how they happened, and what to do about them. Is there a chance that forever chemicals are in your food today? Is there a way to check the ingredient label to know? The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 249, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello, folks. Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the podcast. Jason Bassler is my guest today. Jason is co-founder of the Free Thought Project and has been featured in such publications as Reason, InfoWars, RT, Rolling Stone, and The Tom Woods Show. Jason is also the founder of Police the Police. Jason made headlines when he and his co-founder Matt Agarist were one of the first sites to be deplatformed from Twitter and Facebook. I've invited Jason on to talk about forever chemicals. Hello, Jason. Thank you for joining me today on the Eating Liberty Podcast.
Hey, Dan. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's my pleasure, and we're going to talk about something that's been interesting me for a little while, and there's a good chance most people don't even know this is a thing. Now, I hope, dear listener, you're like, oh, what's that? Well, let's find out. But before we get into our topic is forever chemicals, aren't they all? Let's get a brief bio about you and how you got here.
Sure, man. Yeah, no sweat. My origin story. So I grew up in the Bay Area, California. I feel like I was always surrounded by political discourse one way or another, although my family never really was too into politics. So by the time my teens came around, basically all I knew was Republicans are bad. That was it. Like, that was my extent of politics. I was always interested in activism and politics and what was going on. I guess I just didn't really have like a good grasp on it, but I was motivated, you know, emotionally. I wasn't there logically, but emotionally it was something that I was very passionate about, certain topics. So, you know, when the Iraq War kicked off in 2003, I was out in the streets in San Francisco when I was where I was living at the time. I was protesting. I was doing some anti-war protests with some groups out there. You know, time goes by, things kind of happen, you kind of get caught up in your daily life, and that ended up kind of dissipating as something that I was not doing as frequently. And eventually, about 10 years passed, and the Occupy Wall Street protest happened. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that one. That was around 2011, based in New York, and then it kind of spread all around the world. But it was basically protesting the banks, corporatocracy, the bank bailouts that just had recently happened a couple of years before, and basically all the collusion between government and corporations and banks and the banking industry. And I didn't at that point really understand what was going on, but I saw a lot of my peers. I saw a lot of people in the streets. They were angry. They were frustrated. And I realized, like, hey, I'm now living in the age of information. It's the age of information. Ignorance is a choice, right? Like, so what is, why am I not taking on this opportunity? I have a supercomputer in my pocket right now. Why aren't I taking the opportunity to educate myself, to learn about what's going on? And so that's exactly what I did for the next couple of years. I was just fully invested in trying to educate myself. At that point, you got to also remember this was the internet golden age. So you could literally put up a video on YouTube talking about anything that you like, and it would stay up and it wouldn't be taken down. Nothing would be censored. So there was a lot of great information on the internet. I was reading daily. I was watching videos. I was doing a bunch of work. And locally, I found a couple of groups that seemed to resonate with me. We Are Change Hollywood being one of them. And during that same time was the Ron Paul revolution around 2012, 2011. So I very much was interested in Ron Paul. I'd never, ever supported a politician ever before in my life. But this guy, Ron Paul, he was like speaking my language, right? Like I was all of a sudden gone from like somebody who didn't care about politics to like being this cheerleader for Ron Paul. And he was speaking my language. Everything he was saying was making sense. And of course, he wasn't telling us what we wanted to hear. He was telling us the hard facts. And it kind of just, my spidey senses went off, right? They started tingling. I was like, look, like this guy isn't just a normal politician. He's not just trying to sell his votes, right? Like he's actually trying to tell us things that we need to hear in order to change this and turn the ship around. So that was kind of what led me down my path to libertarianism. And eventually there's that old joke, you know, like what's the difference between anarchy and libertarianism? About 6 months. So, you know, about 6 months after I kind of understood libertarianism. I mean, if you want to be logically consistent and you look at all the information, you look at all the facts, then you're eventually going to wander down the road and the path of anarchism. So that's where I was around the time that I met my business partner, Matt Agaris, who is the co-founder of the Free Thought Project. And in October 2013, we created the Free Thought Project. I should also back up a little bit. Before that, I also created Police the Police, which is my police accountability organization. Not sure if you're familiar with that one, Dan.
I am.
But I also have a strong passion for police accountability. So 2013 comes around, the Free Thought Project is born, and immediately we see amazing results. Like we're getting a bunch of engagement, we're getting a bunch of reach. And from then on, we created a team. We hired 7 writers. We had a team of social media, like 3 different social media team members working on memes and videos. And we were, as I guess you could say, successful. We were thriving. We were reaching millions of people. On some of our good weeks, we were reaching an upward of like 60, 70 million people, which I know sounds crazy, but I have the screenshots to prove it. Again, you have to remember this was the golden age of the internet. And, you know, on some good weeks, we were bringing in somewhere close to between like 30 to 40,000 followers in just a week. So as you could tell, as you could imagine, this was a problem for the establishment. And eventually, by the time 2018 came around, October 2018, exactly the 5-year mark of the Free Thought Project, both Facebook and Twitter took us down, resulting in a loss of nearly 6 million fans. It completely devastated us. That same day, we had to let go of our entire team. We knew we weren't going to have any opportunity to continue paying them because our money was coming in through ad revenue. And when you have that type of reach, you are able to make some money and hire some writers and employees. So my life basically changed, you know, in a matter of a day. My trajectory of my life completely changed in a matter of a day by this, you know, big tech censorship, more or less. And basically, since 2018, we've just been trying to regroup, rebuild, trying to kind of bring back, I guess you could say, the Free Thought Project to its glory days. Although I'm not delusional enough to believe that we'll ever get to nearly 6 million fans again, because they've completely changed the landscape of social media. So I guess in a nutshell, more or less, that's my origin story.
But Elon's our friend.
yeah. Well, this is pre-Elon. Don't forget, you know, 2018. But even still, still to this day, even though Elon said he was going to be restoring accounts, 3 of the Twitter accounts that we had still haven't been restored. So,
All right. So, I don't remember what it was, the specific one, but I read something on Twitter. I found one of your posts talking about forever chemicals.
Sure.
So this is. This is one of those things where you sort of hear about, and I heard about it on another podcast, actually. I don't even know which one it was. And the focus then was on farmland in Maine. Maine, that's pretty far away from me. It's on the other side of the country. Well, that sounds pretty bad for Maine, but I don't think I have anything to worry about. There's a long and fairly gory, gruesome, ugly history of forever chemicals. And we can't do it justice in an hour, can't do it justice in a month, but we can give people a place to start. When they say forever chemical, if you can even pronounce it, and I have it written down, it's really hard to say, what is it and where did it come from?
Sure. Yeah, I completely agree. This is a topic that doesn't get enough airtime. You know, I feel like maybe within the past year or so, we've been hearing more about it. But you're absolutely correct, Dan. It should certainly have a spotlight shined on it more so than it already has. And I believe the tweet that you're referring to, which initiated this conversation between us, was from like a June 5th, I believe, post that I made on Twitter, which said three chemical companies will pay a $1 billion settlement for forever chemicals contaminating U.S. waterways. DuPont will only pay $296.5 million after making $13 billion in 2022 for PFAS that will linger in our bodies and our environment for decades to come. And I finished the tweet by saying, this isn't capitalism, it's criminal. And I stand by that. And, you know, I think I mentioned it to you before we started this podcast. I had a chance to kind of brush up on some information here. So if you don't mind me looking at some of my notes for this, but
go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, PFAS stands for polyfluorokill. So it almost how, you know, if you were to look at the word, if you sounded it out, it's almost how it would sound if you were to put it in that type of frame. But it refers to a class of roughly 15,000 synthetic chemicals used for different purposes, mainly the production of products resistant to water, stains, oil, and heat. And they have become a nuisance, as we mentioned, over particularly the past 30 years or so. They contaminate soils and waterways. They've been found in the blood of people and animals and may have harmful health effects such as cancer, thyroid disease, kidney dysfunction, and congenital disabilities. And I say may, and I kind of emphasize that word because even still, there's a bit of debate online. I saw quite a few people, even on that post that I made, kind of debating what exactly the health effects are going to be or are. So, you know, there's obviously a lot of skepticism right now involving the medical industrial complex, and rightfully so after, you know, the COVID debacle that we just went through over the past 3 years. I think a lot of people have grown kind of wary of scientists and doctors in general. So to a certain extent, I could kind of understand why there's some hesitation as to, you know, believing some of this stuff. But I mean, the more you hear here, I think the more will present itself as common sense that this is kind of a serious issue. So they're called forever chemicals because they don't break down easily in the environment. And of course, they accumulate in the bodies of living organisms, including humans and animals. And that's the accumulations which poses the potential health risk. So they've been manufactured since the 1940s, but only within the past, like I said, like 30 to 40 years have they really become used frequently and have they really been more of a problem. The University of California at San Francisco said that PFAS are now ubiquitous in the population and the environment. So, you know, this isn't something that I know you mentioned that it affects Maine and some of the farms in Maine. This is something that, from my research anyway, is affecting pretty much the entire world. Right now, some of the United States' most widely used food pesticides are also contaminated with potentially dangerous levels of the PFAS. And that's something that we're just now finding out. I just read a Guardian article about that recently. And as you know, a lot of food, most of our food that's conventionally grown is sprayed with pesticides. So this is something, in my opinion, that transcends just a simple chemical making its way throughout the environment. This is something that's become used largely in agriculture and industry. And not only that, I mean, it's in so many different products that, it, as you know, the University of San Francisco said, it's really become ubiquitous in human society.
All right, so it's somewhere in the 1940s, DuPont's the only chemical company I think everybody remembers, and I'm old enough to remember. DuPont actually used to run ads on television for their chemicals. Like, there was another one, some German BFAS or something like that. But they made these things. Now, this is we have, I don't want to diminish the importance of the problem by simply saying we have the luxury of hindsight. But in the 1940s, it's entirely possible that somebody said, wow, we've got this really amazing innovation. And a lot of things between the 1910s or so, you can pick any time you want to, but there was a lot of big innovation in lots of areas, including food. So Crisco came around and they thought that was fantastic. And they put ads on TV. No, they didn't. They put ads in papers, magazines, and make your cakes fluffier and brighter and make your kids healthier with Crisco. Well, we now know more than we did then about all kinds of things. So it's, I don't necessarily want to give them a pass in the 1940s, except maybe they thought they were really doing a great thing by making a chemical that's going to make who knows what, make the clothes fit better, make the food last longer, make the food grow better. So we go into now we have this problem. And so it becomes a really complicated problem. And this is one of the things I've been discovering as I'm reading through this. The thing in – so I brought up Maine. The thing in Maine is they have this – it's called biomass. It's a big sludge. It's in, yes. At least one source seems to be from cesspools. Well, that's kind of gross. So I was like, well, okay, that's not quite as gross as it sounds. Yeah, it actually is. But even – so they're going to take this biomass – and to do something with it, they're going to put it on the ground, till it into the ground, because conceivably, at least on some level, there's some organic material and works for cows. So let's put organic material back into the soil, except there was this one small hiccup. Since the humans had been eating foods that, or consuming some ways, this PFAS, mm-hmm. Yeah, I got it right. It ends up in the waste, so ends up in concentrations, goes into the soil, then the plants get it. Now, there may be other ways that this problem occurs, but let's kind of focus just on the farming part. What happens to the plants that are grown in a biomass PFAS-rich soil? We're creating a circle here, but it's a really big problem. So what exactly is the problem?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, there was three different chemical companies that settled claims recently. And that was DuPont, which you mentioned, Chemours Company, which I'm not familiar with, and Corteva Incorporated. And, you know, they're going to eventually pay $1.1 billion as part of their settlement. And The Guardian recently reported that the state of Maine will also, as you know, we're kind of going over Maine right now, they're going to be, they're one of the first to really take action on this. So they're going to be removing, I've been calling them PFAs. I'm probably saying that wrong. Maybe it is PFASs. Either way. So they are planning on removing the PFAs from sewage sludge, which, as you mentioned, gets reused as fertilizer. That sewage sludge is basically a byproduct of water treatment process that's left over when water is separated and from a human industrial waste. So the PFAs are so widely used in different industrial processes that they're added to, you know, the sewage in high levels. So basically, because there so many people consume different products and have consume these PFAs, they're being found in high levels in the sewage. So years ago, apparently, that same sewage sludge that we were talking about, they were just dumping it in the ocean. And it sounds crazy, right? And that caused numerous environmental problems, such as dead zones. So about 30 years ago, the EPA came up with this fix, which was to approve the sewage sludge for use as fertilizer. So obviously, that's going to have its own problems because these PFAs still contain toxic chemicals that end up in the groundwater and in rivers and streams and eventually our drinking water. And so in Michigan and Maine, they found that the widespread contamination of the soil in every field that they've checked where sludge was spread, and both states have ordered that those tainted farms need to close. So according to the state officials, at least 49 farms in Maine have been found to be contaminated by these PFAS from the sewage sludge used to fertilize agricultural fields. And I guess four of the farms have been shut down. And the state is now investigating about 1,100 different sites where state records date back to the 70s, indicating that this sludge was permitted and used on these different farms. Apparently, it's a slow process. After about a year, Maine has only tested about 182 sites, which is less than 20% of the known locations that have had this sludge spreading. In Maine last year, as we mentioned, became like the first state to ban the practice as, you know, the problem became more and more clear. But the ban kind of created a new challenge, which is like, how do they effectively dispose of the PFAS thoroughly and effectively? So one of the experts that I saw that was talking about this, her name was Laura Orlando, who is a sewage system engineer from Boston University. And apparently an expert on these PFASs, excuse me. And she's basically said it's like a nightmare and that there's not a lot of these facilities that are able to process the PFAS out of the sludge. And that's because it's just such a difficult process. And apparently the PFAS can be eliminated in laboratory settings, but the real world success isn't as easy. So even though that they have several high-level facilities that do this, they've really failed to provide satisfactory results. So, and then another factor to consider as well is like, what is the most responsible way? Like if they're going to just, let's say like burn these off, that process creates air pollution, which is generally not regulated in the U.S. So there's, from what I could tell and from what I researched, there's still a long way to go before there's a successful model of how to dispose of it. And of course, that success would address this growing problem that seems to be, you know, not just in Maine, but across the country. And ultimately, it would be a step in the right direction because as of right now, no filtering or cleaning techniques have been found effective in the real world that have been properly scaled for the large amounts that would be necessary for proper disposal. So
this is a huge problem.
A huge can of worms, right? And as I mentioned, you know, this isn't something that a lot of people know about. And not only that, it's just getting worse and worse by the day. So even the solutions don't seem very promising.
No, I pay a lot of attention to the ingredients on packets of foods that I buy, but I don't read the labels of too many other things. I hadn't seen PFAS listed as a possible ingredient is the wrong word because that implies deliberately I put in flour and water into my biscuit. But element compound something. I don't think that there's a warning label on my t-shirts or my socks that warning this garment may contain PFAS. So
There's certain products, you know, I would say it's the ones that are going to be resistant to water, oil, stains, or heat. So, but as we said, this also includes pesticides that get sprayed on our food, right? So they're not just in pesticides, though. They're in takeout containers, you know, again, trying to, you know, something that's resistant to heat, fast food wrappers. One of the articles I read said, you know, try not to handle fast food wrappers. I mean, the more you touch it, the more you have it on your body, the more you're going to be absorbing these PFAS, you know, carpets.
I think that complaint overlooks the fact that, first of all, the food was on the wrapper. Like, wait a minute, people.
You're
putting a Big Mac wrapper in your pocket when, by the way, the food was in there for...
don't leave it in the wrapping, you know, like take it out as quick as possible.
Let's eliminate the problem entirely and don't eat fast food.
Sure.
That's
a simple solution.
That's an easy solve. So it sounds like there is nothing, there's no place to go that is completely free of a PFAS we'll say exposure. I don't want to say contamination because I offer disclaimers because this is not health advice. So the doctor from Boston University said that this is really, really hard to get rid of in a practical real world setting.
I have read that
they cannot easily be destroyed, which supports what she said, including they are not necessarily destroyed in the burning process. So even if they were incinerated, it sounds like, well, people may not know this, but if you burn poison ivy, you may have gotten rid of the poison ivy off your property. The problem is that you've made the volatile oil in the plant airborne, and when you breathe poison ivy smoke, you get poison ivy in your lungs, and that's not a good place to get poison ivy. So PFAS in your lungs through smoke sounds like a worse problem. It's hard to imagine it would be worse, but it sounds like a worse problem. Let's focus on the U.S. Is there possibly a place that is not contaminated somehow, either in the water or the food products or the agriculture? Is there some place that's free from PFAS?
So it seems like because it's used in food pesticides, most food is contaminated with potentially dangerous levels of toxic PFASs. And as I was saying, you know, I mean, it's just in everything. It's in shampoos, it's in leather, it's in textile furnishing. I mean, not everything, but it feels like almost everything. Of course, the nonstick coating frying pans, like the Teflon frying pans, paint, and even the firefighting foams that firefighters use. So the fertilizer has also been polluted with PFAS. I mean, from what I could tell, it didn't really seem like there was any places that have been exempt from this. The FDA began monitoring PFAS in food in 2019 and has detected them in fruits and vegetables, but as of right now, hasn't set any limits. So, as far as, you know, the U.S. goes, I haven't actually heard of any place that's kind of, you know, been exempt from the storm of the PFAS. And I guess it makes sense just because they're everywhere. You know, they're in our food, they're in our water, they're in our drinking water. They're in many of the products that we buy. So it looks like there are some steps that are being taken to like try to fix things, but it's just at such a small scale. And even the, you know, what I was just mentioning, the fine that these companies got, you know, I mean, it's such a small amount. It's not even a slap on the wrist. You know, if DuPont's only paying $296.5 million, that's nothing to them. That's chump change, right? They made $13 billion in 2022. So, I mean, this is nothing. And if this is going to be the way that we punish these companies who do participate in polluting the environment with these, then it's going to just continue more of the same, you know, until there's some type of serious consequences.
I don't know the answer to this, and I'd be interested to find out if you know the answer. For pesticides on certified organic farms, is a PFAS an ingredient and a compound in organic fertilizers? Do you know?
I don't believe it's supposed to be. In fact, this morning I read a story, a heartbreaking story about a family farm, the Dosti farm, I believe, they were an organic farm. They were organic dairy farm. They were selling organic milk to Stonyfield Farms for years, and they were doing well. And they all of a sudden got a message back from Stonyfield Farms saying, hey, look, like your product is tested hot for these PFASs, and basically they've tried everything that they could do to try to, fix their facility. They bought in a new, they bought a brand new $40,000 water purifier. I guess part of the organic stipulations, though, if you do want your food to be considered organic, is that your cows actually have to be in the pasture for a certain amount of time for their health and well-being. Mm-hmm. And their fields were just contaminated through the PFAS And there was really nothing that they could do about it. They tried to outsource different pastures. So then, you know, the costs increased where they had to actually bring in trucks to haul their cows over to certain areas. And all that obviously becomes more expensive. It becomes more pollution just from all that. And they had to, you know, they could no longer feed their cattle with, you know, the grass that was on the land. So they had to import more grass and buy silos for that. And it's become this huge problem. And I also want to mention really quick about this family farm story is that they were doing everything that they were supposed to do. Again, Maine told them, the EPA told them to use a sewer sludge to, you know, help with their fields, to fertilize their fields. And so they were doing everything that they're supposed to. And you know, what, 20 years later, the EPA comes back around saying, well, look, now you're testing hot for these PFAS. And so it's kind of this double-edged sword, right? Like the EPA is telling you to do one thing, and now they're over here making it so you have to close down your business and in your farm. And this is a family farm that's been around for, you know, decades, and now they have their hands in the air. They don't know what they're going to do. They have to change professions, basically. And this is not new. You know, the farms around the world, they're decreasing at an alarming rate. So
well, if anything, for a variety of reasons.
Right, right. Not just for this reason, but absolutely, yeah, there's a variety of reasons. So, you know, if anything, we need to preserve and cherish and protect our family farms, if anything.
So let's go back to the DuPont and those other companies' judgment of payment. So they're going to give farmers cash. How does that make farmers whole? I mean, but it seems like an effort and the right step to punish the chemical producers, which I'm not entirely, it's not important to the case. I'm not convinced that they are singularly the first source of this problem, but that's not part of the, it's another issue. But they're going to give loads of buckets of cash to farmers. And how does that make the farmers better? What happens when the farm, either they continue a new way to farm, and I don't know what that is because I'm not in agriculture, and either that works or it doesn't work, or they don't farm and they run out of cash. Now what? I mean, what is this? This seems like an appeasement, and I don't sure. know what's happening down the street. Do you have any ideas about how this makes the farmers whole, or what are next steps if this stuff is just everywhere? Even if you were to make a new raised bed, or go hydroponic. Conceivably, you can't get away from it.
Right. I wasn't able to find any information as to how that $1.1 billion was allocated or if it was even a settlement that was going towards the farmers. In fact, I would probably be kind of surprised if it was. It seems like in this case, it's probably going straight to the federal government as a fine, you know? So that was my... Sure. No, that was my interpretation anyway. I could be wrong about that, but I'd have to double check on that. But when I was talking about this family farm, this Dosti family farm, they actually mentioned that there was the state of Maine, the lawmakers created a $60 million fund to help the PFAS impacted farmers. And this gentleman, this farmer was really hoping he was, you know, was really optimistic that he would be able to get a piece of that to help restore and recover his farm. But he basically said that there were so many legal hurdles and hoops that you had to jump through, and that the process was so slow moving that by the time it would be allocated out to him, that his farm would already be closed anyway. So I don't think there's much of a government solution here that is going to be actually feasible, unfortunately, you know. And again, like, you know, government is a monopoly on the legal use of force, right? And so on one hand, it's like our only option, but on the other hand, the wheels of government turn so slow and the incentives really go in the opposite direction of the everyday average working person or farmer, right? Because we know the collusion between these corporations and government. So I don't think we should place our hope on a government solution. Let me just put it that way. It does appear, though, that there has been some shifts in the right direction. Currently, right now, neither state or federal regulations require milk to be tested for PFASs. But the EPA has set health advisory levels for PFAs in drinking water and has taken steps to phase out some of the PFAs. So I guess that's a step in the right direction. Also, a number of major companies, including McDonald's and Burger King, have stated that they're planning on reducing or completely phasing out packaging with these forever chemicals. And on like a state level, Portland is developing a facility right now that could eventually use the technology to safely reduce and eliminate the biosolid or the PFAs from those biosolids, at which we were talking about earlier, which is basically
which
the sludge. What's that?
Which Portland?
You're Portland, I believe.
Oh, Oregon, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I believe so. There's some hope for that, right? Because that could be something that could fix the problem. But of course, this is something that's typically done at high heat, like the technology that they're using. So again, we have this problem. The Washington Department of Ecology recently adopted new rules that will prohibit the use of toxic chemicals like PFAs in certain consumer products. And January 2025, manufacturers, distributors, and retailers must comply or face restrictions or fines. So I also found that to date, the Agriculture Department has paid about $2 million to 17 different farms to reimburse for wages and livestock lost to PFASs. And they also help with some of the testing and filtration, because a lot of times I found that these farms themselves don't have the resources or the ability to test for these PFASs. So a lot of times they are usually contacted by the people who they're selling their product to after they've spent, you know, $100,000 on these tests. These tests aren't cheap. So I guess the government is also stepping up to help pay for some of the testing and filtration, and some grants also. You could apply for some grants to, you know, get replacement feed and build greenhouses and change crops and stuff. But again, this is, in my opinion, more of a Band-Aid than any type of significant reform, you know. And basically the government's only taken just the most modest steps to protect the public from PFAs. And
after they said, go ahead and do it.
Yeah, well, behind our backs, of course. I mean, that's usually how these things go, you know. It doesn't look good as of right now. I think it would certainly help if more people like us were talking about it. More people like us were doing interviews. More people like us were on social media screaming from the rooftops. Mm. But again, you know, people in our situation are kind of against the wall, because we don't necessarily call for government solutions, right? And as of right now, it seems like that's one of the only avenues to really try to put a clamp down on this. But even still, that government solutions, as we just mentioned, are slow moving. It depends on the incentives, if they're actually trying to look out for the people, or if they're going to be paid back behind closed doors, you know, with lobbyists. And I mean, we know these backdoor deals exist. We know cronyism exists. So the problem is there's no real free market solution right now that I know of.
So I'm going to put you on the spot, and I didn't expect to ask this question, and I don't expect you to have a fully formed response, but, and this could be a whole other hour show, but don't take an hour. What do you see as a possible anarchist solution to this problem? Now, the problem, the challenge with the question is that the anarchists wasn't involved in the beginning, but now we have this gigantic dumpster fire here. Go put it out, Spidey Pants.
Yeah,
all
sure.
Right, so it's an unfair assessment, because you had no part in creating the problem. Well, fine, you're the smart, you go fix it. But
yeah,
and that's what we're thrown up against. Well, what would you do there, smart guy? Okay, well,
yeah.
What would be at least one possible or several possible ways that a non-government solution or solutions could This isn't an overnight fix. That's the first. No matter who does it, this isn't changing tomorrow.
Sure.
On July 1st, the problem doesn't disappear, no matter who's involved. So,
yeah. No, I'm so glad you asked this, Dan, because we have to talk about solutions, right? Like, it's so important. We can't just talk about, you know, the problem. And even when we have the knowledge, it's important to talk about solutions and not only talk about solutions, but take action. So my answer is kind of a template, I guess you could say, which could probably be applied to a bunch of various different scenarios. But basically, the problem here is that government claims a monopoly on the legal use of force. So by doing that, it claims the legal right to create certain conditions for, let's say, agencies like the EPA to be a monopoly on environmental protection, or the FDA for food and drug safety, right? And it's kind of counterintuitive to think that, well, hey, having multiple options here, having competition in a free market is the solution. But ultimately, that is the solution, because the problem is when there is one monopoly, and especially when it's a government monopoly, they're going to be susceptible to bribery, to incentives, to lobbying. And that's exactly what we see. That's exactly why DuPont got a slap on the wrist here for decades worth of chemical, polluting the environment with these different chemicals. So if there were competition within the environmental protection, and there wasn't just one agency that was claimed the right to do so, then we would eventually weed out what corporations or what companies or what firms could actually be reliable. Because if they were taking bribes, let's say from DuPont, and if that was something that was exposed to the general public and people caught wind of that, then we would all decide to do something like a Target boycott, right? And I'm sure you heard about the most recent Target boycott or the most recent Bud Light boycott. But when the government claims a monopoly and claims that these agencies are the one and only that can exist, and they have this legal, righteous authority to put in place any type of regulation that they want, and not only that, to protect the environment, to protect our bodies, our children, then they're going to be susceptible to corruption. So at the end of the day, that's the problem, is that these are monopolies. These government agencies are monopolies that could be bought and sold. And in a free market where there would be competition, the most trustworthy firm would rise to the top and would eventually be adopted throughout communities across the country because they've proven themselves to be trustworthy. They've proven themselves to be effective. They've proven themselves to be efficient with our tax dollars, unlike government. And you could say all three of those things. Government has no incentive to be efficient. Government has no incentive to be accountable. Government has no incentive to be effective with what it's doing, because at the end of the day, are they going to be there in another 3 or 4 years? Probably not. There's an analogy that I always try to tell people when I'm talking about government is, look, would you change the tires or get an oil change in a rental car? Probably not, right? It's a rental car. Why in the hell would you bother doing that stuff? Well, government's just a vehicle to politicians for advantages for their friends and, smaller firms and anybody that they're trying to bring up, you know, and unfortunately that gets abused frequently. It's to the point where that abuse has become normalized in society. So when we talk about these forever chemicals being a consistent problem for decades now, it's not that it's because, you know, the government wasn't aware of them. It's because they're in bed with these corporations, these companies, and they wanted to keep it quiet so people like us weren't talking about it. So in a free market, that completely flips on its head. The incentives gets changed around, and there actually becomes more of a demand for transparency and accountability.
So, yes, government is a monopoly and has the luxury of infallibility. So looking through this, trying to figure out, I didn't find out the 1940s, but I did find out in 1981, EPA published a paper. I might butcher this because the EPA is not, does not economize words on titles of papers. The thing was called Institutional Constraints and Public Acceptance Barriers to Utilization of Municipal Wastewater and Sludge for Land Reclamation and Biomass Production. So what that means is, in 1981, they put out a paper how to strong-arm opponents and resistors to using this PFAS biomass sludge. So that's some 42 years ago, they knew they had a problem. And it's kind of appalling.
Sure. But again, this is what government does, you know, and you can look at the military-industrial complex and apply the same type of mentality to it, or that you could look at it and same thing to the medical-industrial complex, you know, and I mean, this is just how government works. Unfortunately, most of us have been indoctrinated in government slave camps for, you know, the first 12, 15 years of our lives, you know, so... No, it's funny that you mentioned that, though, because I also found some information that in 1959, DuPont scientists found that PFAS is in large lab rats' livers and likely caused birth defects in workers. And still, the company told its employees that the compounds in it are as toxic as table salt. And between 1961 and 2006, dozens of instances where DuPont and 3M scientists discovered or acknowledged PFASs, their toxic internality, and they didn't publish the findings or report on them, which is required by the EPA as under federal law. And yeah, I also saw that in the 1980s, DuPont found elevated liver enzymes in 60% of workers tested.
Jeez.
And yeah, a confidential internal report detailed birth defects among pregnant plant employees. And the years that followed, 3M and DuPont internal studies found that the chemicals likely cause prostate, testicular, bladder, and kidney cancers. And I mean, there's more too. I could keep going here. Like this is the EPA, as we were just saying, and DuPont are in bed together, right? So in 2006, the DuPont vice president, Susan Stalnecker, wrote an email to the EPA saying, urgent EPA action needed, and quote, we need the EPA to quickly, like first thing tomorrow, say the following. One, that consumer products sold under the Teflon brand are safe, and two, further to date, there are no human health effects known to be caused by PFOA, which is a type of PFAS. And so this is, you know, this was back in 2006. I mean, this has been going on forever and they continue to cover it up. They continue to do everything that they can to assure the public, assure consumers that these products are safe, all while making billions of dollars.
No, no one can see your cap, but it reads meme word veteran. And it reminds me this whole comply or pay a fine, what that really means to me is everything's allowable, just some things cost more. So we don't have to report to the government. We'll just pay them a couple hundred grand and that's fine. And absolutely, we still don't have to give the report. We pay the fine and still get to keep the secrets. So, all right, I'm going to move into a different part of the show because we could belabor this forever, and I think we've got a good start. I'm going to put a few links to some of this information I found in one article I thought was really a good place to begin on today's show notes page, which is culinarylibertarian.com/249. This portion of the show is called, they call it, they've named it for me, the lightning round. So it's just a couple of short, quick answer kinds of questions. Of the five flavors, sweet, salty, bitter, sour, or umami, which one is your favorite?
I am a sweet guy. Yeah, I am a sweet guy.
What's your favorite food?
Probably have to go Mexican. Yeah, Mexican. It's just so diverse. There's so much you could do with it, you know?
What's your least favorite food?
Mediterranean. Yeah.
Wow.
I know, right? It's one of the healthiest, but I'm not a big fan of the pita bread and all that stuff. So.
What sound do you love?
What sounds do I love? That's an interesting one. Well, I'm a musician. I played music for the first, 20 years of my life. I toured, I made records, all that stuff. But the first thought that came into my mind was birds in the morning. So I'm going to go with that one.
It's a good sound. What sound do you hate?
Right now, my one-year-old daughter screaming.
Congratulations, honestly. Jason, by the way, that never, ever stops.
Yeah, she's a sweet girl.
For 18 years.
But, oh, God, man, I could be okay with not hearing that again for the rest of my life.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, what gets you excited?
Gets me excited. This work. Yeah, this type of work, man. I've been so pushed in a corner. I've been so censored. I've been silenced. I've been demonetized. I've been deplatformed. And at the end of the day, it just makes me that much more passionate about doing this. So, yeah, I don't think I'll ever stop.
What turns you off?
Intellectual laziness. People who don't care for intellectual integrity. I feel like that's a big problem in society. And that's one thing that we could all work on, I think.
What's your favorite color?
I'm going to give you two, black and yellow.
If you could cook for anyone ever, who would that be?
Man, I was kind of thinking they're going to be more like activism, freedom related. Let me think here. Anybody, huh?
This is a culinary show.
Oh, true. Yes. My grandmother, bless her soul. She was always a wonderful cook and always made me great meals. And within the past 5 years or so, I've taken up cooking a little bit more, and I can't say I'm good at it, but I would love to kind of return the favor to her. So.
It's a very good answer. And by the way, you don't have to be good at it. You have to enjoy what it is you make and enjoy what it is you feed your friends. And there's lots of room to get better. That's all okay.
Well said, my friend.
What's your favorite food indulgence?
Ice cream. It's a curse. Keep it away from me, but I love it so much.
Yeah, I know that, bro.
Oh, man.
How can people follow you?
Yeah, so I am on just about every social media platform that you could think of. Yeah, well, we learned our lesson. You know, after Facebook and Twitter took us down, I realized that putting all of your eggs in one basket is not the best way of going about it. So I am on primarily, my two biggest accounts are Instagram, jason.e.bassler, and Twitter, jasonbassler1. Otherwise, I'm on Telegram, MeWe, Minds, Gab, pretty much all of them. Yeah, just type me in the search bar and you'll be able to find me. Also, the Free Thought Project, we're on almost all of them as well. The Free Thought Project, www.thefreethoughtproject.com. If you guys enjoy Dan's podcast, you might enjoy ours as well. At the top of the Free Thought Project webpage, we have our podcast tab there. Definitely check it out. We've had a bunch of great guests. We even had the great Ron Paul a couple months ago. We had Tom Woods last week, like a bunch of people who are, you know, integral factors, integral parts of the libertarian movement. So definitely check that out. But yeah, come follow me, please.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I will put those links on the show notes page. Once again, culinarylibertarian.com/249. Jason, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for your time. Absolutely. I know we could have gone over just so much more, but I think it's a good start anyway to at least let the listeners know there is this thing out there that sure. The government said's fine, then changed their mind on, and now you can't get away from it.
Yeah, it's like everywhere. And you know what? We didn't even get into microplastics. I mean, those are everywhere too. We didn't get into atrazine. We didn't get into, all these different things. And, you know, there's a lot to be said, and it feels overwhelming. So I think it's appropriate to end the show where we ended it. But thank you again, Dan, for having me on. I enjoyed this conversation, and let's do it again.
We probably will. Thank you very much. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I asked Meriwether the forager and biochemist how it is that a forever chemical doesn't break down. Enzymes was the answer. Now, I know only just enough to know that I don't know anything more than enzymes are what breaks chemicals down. It seems that the absence of enzymes that prefer forever chemicals is one of the big problems. Now, I don't know how we fix that, and that's another show. Jason had a schedule to keep, so there is no chef's table with him for this episode. Patreon subscribers do have access to all of the previous chef's table episodes, as well as the bonus content that is on Patreon. Become a patron on Patreon with the link on the show notes page. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you being here. Have a happy and safe 4th of July. Take care that all of you is intact, fingers and toes and eyeballs, on July 5th. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.